Welcome, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. After the September 11th attacks in New York and other places around the country, anti-Muslim hate crimes spiked, moving from the second lowest reported to the second highest, according to FBI data. And in the years following 9/11, anti-Muslim hate crimes declined from a high of 27%. But data reported to the FBI indicates a rise in Islamophobia in more recent years. And while hate crimes against religious groups overall have declined, anti-Muslim incidents have increased. Last year, of the 1,100 hate crimes targeting religious groups, 16% were against Muslims. And that's about a 10% increase from 2013 and an 18% increase from the year before that, 2012. So in the wake of attacks last month in Beirut, in Paris, daily reports of Islamophobic acts throughout Europe and North America are continuing to surface. From quote-unquote Middle Eastern-looking people removed from flights to quell the fears of passengers, to mosques vandalized and set on fire, and individuals attacked and called terrorists. So, joining us today to discuss this rise in Islamophobia and what can really be done to fight it are three guests. First, we have Noura Abdelal, is a 17-year-old Palestinian born and raised in San Francisco, and is a student here at Burton High School, where we are headquartered. And she became involved with the San Francisco-based Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, to vocalize her opinions about injustices in Palestine. And she joins me in studio. Thanks for coming in, Noura.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we also have Moaz Inam, is a sophomore at Zaytuna College. It's the first accredited Muslim college in the United States, right here in Berkeley. He's pursuing a Bachelor of Arts degree in Islamic Law and Theology, and he's also in studio. Welcome to KLW.
Thank you so much for having us. Hi.
And on the line with us is Mustafa Bayoumi, author of This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror, which was published in September by NYU Press. He's a professor of English at Brooklyn College, City College of New York, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Thanks for joining us, Mustafa.
Hi, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And we want to invite you into the conversation as well. If you have been a target of Islamophobia, or if you've witnessed it happening in front of you, we want to hear your stories. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. How has this war on terror and these recent attacks affected the way maybe that you present yourself and go about in the world or not? How are your friends dealing with it? How are your coworkers dealing with this? And what do you think it will take to change minds and to change policies? Again, the number is 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. So, following the Paris attacks, specifically the Paris attacks last month, the hashtag not in my name started trending on social media, among other things. Of course, many people were thinking, you know, why just the Paris attacks? The Beirut attacks happened right before it, and many other attacks in many places. But this is a time when, you know, people on social media were talking about, here it is again, Islamophobia, young Muslims and all Muslims really feeling like, again, defending, quote unquote, themselves, their religion, not in my name, this is not me, again. Yeah, and I say again because Muslims have been through this before. And at the same time, reports of hate crimes are increasing. First, I wanted to see, Noura, what do you see in recent times?
Well, growing up, I always did feel guilty whenever I saw like terrorist attacks on TV or in the news, which isn't normal. I shouldn't have to feel guilty because I have nothing to do with it. And with the not in my name hashtag, I feel like it's really unnecessary. Like, people always expect me to apologize for things I didn't even do. They say, we need to know if Muslims condemn this, otherwise we're just going to assume that you just want all people to die. And it's really frustrating for me, because it's a mentality that a lot of people have, that if you don't stand up and I guess condemn every single attack there is, then they're just going to assume that you're with ISIS or that you're a terrorist.
And that's not just at the high school level where you are, because even, you know, at the level of people who are much older than you, you know, why haven't Muslims come out and marched against ISIS? You know, why haven't Muslims done this or that? Muaz, what has been your experience?
So, born and raised in Dallas, Texas, and also considering the fact that for me, I'm only seeing this kind of unravel in more recent years, I feel right now I'm blessed to be in the Bay Area, where I think things are a lot, where people are a lot more receptive, a lot more open. But my own community in Dallas right now, we're seeing armed protests, people showing up right in front of our mosques, our prayer spaces, with just rifles and stuff like that. And to me, it's scary. I worry about my parents. My parents are there. My siblings, nephews, nieces are all there. So I worry about it. I know whenever, personally, as I feel that the female within our community are a lot more recognizable as Muslims because of the headscarf. And for that, I know my wife, more so than myself, whenever things like this happen, she worries about going out. Personally, I can't say I've been a victim of Islamophobia, at least directly. In fact, I feel like I've witnessed more Islamophobia directed towards Sikhs who aren't Muslims, but often are mistaken as Muslims. Just the other day driving, I saw a couple of people. To me, it's strange. It's strange because I feel like we've gotten to a point where a lot of this has become taboo when it's directed towards other groups. But for some reason, this is sticking for Muslims, at least for the time being.
And what did you witness? What was the thing that happened?
It was strange. There was a man that was trying to get into, he was just literally trying to turn in. There's a red light. And there was enough space for him to get through. And he was trying to get through, and you can see that people would stop, and then they'd look at him, and then they'd move forward. Mm-hmm. And it was strange because I was in one lane. There's two lanes. In the first lane, I had stopped to let him go. And the second lane had stopped, and then they'd see him, and then they'd keep going. And to the point where it's a red light, so you're not getting anywhere, right? And so there's no reason to close that path off. But it was strange, and you could see the frustration in his face because he stood there for quite a while, just waiting. And it was strange because my wife was sitting there. She was getting really upset, too, because she was like, this happens to me all the time. Mm. Whereas I can't say I experienced that as directly because I'm not as recognizable
visibly
as a Muslim.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So tell me more about your family in Texas, because we've been hearing about these armed protesters outside of the mosques there. What are they doing? What are they saying?
So where the community that we were raised in, Richardson and Plano, there hasn't been as much going on there. Garland, which is fairly close, is where you had the hate rally that took place, and then there was the gunman that showed up, and people were killed. That was a couple of months back. And then Irving, which is the community that's been coming under a lot of, which is where a lot of these protests have been happening, which is only about 30 miles or so. So it wasn't the community that we necessarily grew
right
up in or frequented, but it was certainly nearby.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been strange because you have people that are condemning violence. They don't want to see Muslims flourishing, yet they're showing up with rifles. And people are terrified, right? Because you have people with rifles right outside your door. A lot of people that perhaps served in the military that spend a lot of time basically directed towards killing Muslims that they believed were terrorists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so coming here now and perhaps not being able to distinguish between the two is terrifying because you have people showing up with armed weapons at a religious place, which to us is very sacred, and the place where violence is just not supposed to happen at all.
And Mustafa Bayoumi in New York, you are in New York, a very diverse place, but also the place where the two towers came down on 9/11. So it's a very tense place for Muslims. What have you been seeing recently since the rise of ISIS and these recent attacks?
Yeah, I think that there's a growing level of anxiety that we see in the community here. You know, I feel it every once in a while when you see when you hear about these flare-ups or you see them on television. I think I felt that anxiety right after the 9/11 attacks. I felt that anxiety myself. You know, it almost becomes somatic to me. I find it hard to breathe. I felt that right after the Ground Zero mosque kerfuffle, the hysteria around that happened back in 2010, and then after the Paris attacks, I was feeling it once again. You know, there is this terrible sense that there is violence pending. There's a kind of exclusionary rhetoric that happens, and it's not limited, of course, to New York City. I mean, you see it from the political class as well. The Republican leaders have been following all over themselves in many cases, trying to out-Islamophobe the other.
Mm. And so your book, This Muslim American Life, Dispatches from the War on Terror, just published this past September. What did you really want to chronicle in there?
Yeah, I think so my book, This Muslim American Life, is really looking at the idea that there is a kind of war on terror culture that we've established in the United States in these last, you know, 14 to 15 years. And one way of thinking about that, I think, is to think about if we think about back into the Cold War and we think about what Cold War culture is, I think we can easily think about Cold War culture as being various stereotyping of people who are coming from the former USSR. And it's not just coming from the cultural side. It's also coming from the legal side, from the idea that that culture and law and society and the politics are all working together to kind of create a kind of fortress America that really excludes and simplifies life outside of the borders of the United States. And I feel like what we're seeing with Muslim Americans is very similar, and it's even more problematic since you have, you know, 3 to 8 million Muslim Americans in this country already. I think it's very important to consider the ways that we've fallen into this very simplistic, we meaning a general American culture, simplistic equation of Muslim equals terrorist. And I think we need to really understand the kind of daily life and experiences that Muslim Americans inhabit.
And again, the number to give us a call and join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. If you'd like to ask any of our panelists a question, or if you have an experience you'd like to share or an idea, give us a call, 866-798-8255, or shoot us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to go to you again, Nora, this idea that Mustafa was talking about, that Muslims can't seem to get beyond the Muslim equals terrorist, and this idea of the other and the immigrant person coming into America, and you're different, you have different values, a different religion, not realizing that you're American, and you have to keep telling your colleagues, the people around you, that, you know, I'm American. I mean, the idea of the other isn't really valid here, because I'm here, I'm part of the fabric of this society, and I'm not a terrorist. Is that something you have to keep saying to people? Or,
well, I remember one time I went to the library, right? And people typically go to the library to study.
Hopefully.
And I walk in, and this man is just glaring at me. And I think, okay, maybe he's staring off into space, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt. And I give him a little smile, and he just continues staring. And I'm like, okay. And I go to take my seat, and this man is still staring at me. And I think, okay, I start doing my work. I look up about like 15 seconds later, and he's still just glaring at me. And it made me feel really isolated and uncomfortable to be in that position.
And just for our listeners, they can't see you, but you do wear the headscarf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I do. And it's little things like that. Like, if I go to a store, I don't get approached. People don't ever ask me, like, if they can help me. It's really seldom that it happens that a customer service person's like, how are you doing today? They just stand uncomfortably behind counters. And I can see that. And another aspect of it is when I do tell friends or people sometimes, they just tell me that I'm overreacting or that I'm being overly sensitive. And I really do feel isolated a lot of the times, but it's not really validated as much.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that is because, is that recent, these things that are happening to you, or?
Well, I started wearing the scarf when I was 12 years old, and it mainly did start happening when I wore the scarf, that even if people were to smile at me, I would still get a sense that they were really uncomfortable.
Hmm, interesting. And Moaz, your wife, is she feeling an increased level of this kind of Islamophobia or not, as a visible Muslim again?
Mm-hmm. You mean in wake of the Paris attacks?
Yes, recently.
I can't say that she has, and that's, again, that comes from me having not necessarily, because I feel like there's a lot of things that I take for granted as a man that's not necessarily recognized, right, as a Muslim. And so I realize in conversations with her sometimes there's a lot of things that that to me, almost like we would talk of white privilege, I have this non-wearing hijab privilege. And I don't recognize a lot of the things that she does because she wears a scarf.
In the past, the beard might have done it, but now there's like hipster beards.
But now the beard's cool.
Now the beard's cool.
Now the beard's cool. So I can't say that I have, but that's not to discount that she hasn't, right? Just uh-huh. Because she's at a point where she doesn't, when something's so normalized, you don't speak about it anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? And so I'm sure Noura can relate. When you go to the store and this happens again, or you go to the library, it happens again. It's not something that you're just going to keep bringing up every single time because you just it becomes so normalized for you.
And Noura, does that make you do things differently? Does that make you live your life differently at all? Change your mind from going somewhere or wrapping the headscarf differently or...
Well, I really have thought about it. I was like, oh my God, this is too much. Maybe I should just take it off. And then I think, well, I thought this is a country where you could practice your religion for free, but I really feel like I can't practice my religion for free if every time I go outside, people are just going to, like, treat me differently, especially in neighborhoods like the Mission where a lot of new people are moving in, and I walk and people stare at me.
The new people. We're
the new people, yeah. And I'm just like, I was born here.
So. You're new. You're the one who's new. I've been here. Interesting. So again, that number is 866-798. Talk. The lines are filling up, but we do have some that are open, and we will start to take your calls shortly. And the email again is feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you think about what you're seeing in the media in regards to this, you know, portraying of Muslims, reaction to the terror attacks? Is there enough coverage of the Islamophobia that happens? What have you been seeing? Mustafa Bayoumi, can you start us off on that?
Yes, certainly. But I wonder if I could just address one other issue first.
Sure.
And that's related to the questions that you were just asking about sort of the daily interactions of Muslims in this country.
Mm.
And I think that there is a lot of heightened scrutiny and pressure there. But I think sometimes we also forget about the other kinds of consequences that can happen. And I think employment discrimination is, I think, one that we can consider really deeply, especially with that, how that attaches to names, Muslim names. So it's not just about appearing Muslim on the street, but it's also about appearing Muslim on a resume. And I can give you an example from an organization in California called the Discrimination Resource Center that did this study several years ago. And what they did was they sent around 5,000 similarly qualified resumes around the whole state. And these resumes were fake. They weren't actually attached to real people, but they were fake resumes that had ethnically identifiable names because mm-hmm. they wanted to see who had the best chance of getting a job and who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had the best chance of getting a job if your name was Heidi McKenzie, and you had the worst chance of getting a job if your name was Abdulaziz Mansour.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not the only study that has found these kinds of results. And so I think we should think beyond sort of daily interactions and the horrible incidents of hate violence, because it's also seeped into a kind of, you know, regular culture awareness. So I think that's important to underline.
And how does that happen? What do you do?
Oh, yes.
How does that happen, Mustafa? What when we talk about changing people's minds, changing, you know, having conversation, what, where and how does that happen?
I think it's a really, it's a very complicated, layered question, and it has to do with so many different elements of our society. But on the one hand, I think it's also important to recognize that most Americans have had almost no contact with Muslims personally. Other polling data will bear this out. It's upwards of 60-70% of Americans have never even met a Muslim person in their lives. But you can be pretty sure at this point that 100% of Americans have an opinion about Muslims. Mm. And so part of the, you know, on one level, I think it's really important that we, on the most simplistic level and the most simple level, is that we just actually try to get to know each other and get to know the Muslims who are around the corner. In fact, those same polls will show that the people who have, in fact, met a Muslim, their levels of hostility go way down when it comes to Islam. And in some ways, it's a no-brainer, because as soon as you actually know somebody as a person, it's harder to hold these kinds of opinions about them.
Mm. So that's on kind of the personal level. What about on a bigger level, on a community level, on a city level? Can things...
Right.
Yeah. What can be facilitated? Yeah.
Well, I think that one of the things that's really different about it's not exclusively different, but it's somewhat different from how we think about sort of relations with the other in this country. When we tend to think about questions of racial politics, minority politics, we tend to think about them in the domestic sphere only. But when it comes to questions around Muslims in the United States, our fate here is so closely connected to what's happening overseas as well at the same time. So I think that there has to also be concerted efforts to try to reduce the levels of violence overseas and across the world. And so if we can, even at the city level, you know, we can be having building peace movements and trying to understand how the solution to our current predicament is not more war, but less war. Our politicians seem to believe that as soon as anything happens across the world, the only answer that they seem to have is to continue to bomb someplace else. And I think that we have to come to an understanding that when we bomb, we're not actually finding peace. We're actually just increasing war.
All right. That is Mustafa Bayoumi, author of This Muslim American Life. Nicely named there, Mustafa, who is joining us from New York. With us also is Nora Abdelal, a high school student right here at Burton High School, where KALW is headquartered. And with us also is Moaz Inam, a student at Zaytuna. And we are talking about Islamophobia, what the experience is, how to fight it, how to deal with it, how to make it possibly go away. And we are taking your calls, full lines, but we will take them after this short break. For those of you joining us now, I'm Hanat Baba, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, very different topic. We'll have a conversation about the 2016 Super Bowl, which will affect the Bay Area. An estimated 1 million people will partake in the Super Bowl's week-long activities. San Francisco, Santa Clara, San Jose, they're all vying for fans who are pouring into the Bay Area, ready to splurge. How will this affect residents here? And if you have a show idea for us, drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. But today we have a panel of young American Muslims. We're talking about the recent rise in Islamophobia following the rise of ISIS and attacks around the world, particularly the one that has gotten the most attention, which is the Paris attacks. So give us a call. We are taking your calls at 866-798-TALK, and we will go to your calls now. Let's go to our first caller. Hi, you're on your call.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, you didn't say my name, so I wasn't sure I was up. This is Richard in San Francisco.
Hi, Richard.
Hey, I got to say first that I support no religion. I find them very divisive, so let's get that put to one side. I think this is all about the general media giving America the facts, and they don't do this. You know, if we look at what Christianity has done around the around the world, in South America, the North American Indians, and so on, even in Muslim countries during the Crusades, it was truly horrific. You know, we've gone around the world since World War II, overthrowing democratic governments, invading countries. There's estimated around 4 million civilians have been killed by the West, generally led by America, and I'm talking about, of course, Vietnam and in Iraq and Central America and so on. We've been training secret services. Several democratically elected people have been overthrown just to support big oil and big agriculture. And can you imagine if in some country, maybe the Middle East or anywhere, we're sending drones over Washington, killing our generals, our politicians, our religious leaders, this country would be very, very angry. I don't think there are any Syrians in the Ku Klux Klan. I don't think there are any Syrians in the Ferguson Police Department. I don't know how many are in the NRA, but I'll bet you can count on one hand. Timothy McVeigh was not a Syrian or a Muslim. For as far as I know, these school shooters and the guy that went to the abortion clinic last week were white, angry people. And just one last thing before we, before I sign off. 9/11, we lost 2,500 Americans. The other 500 were mostly from the rest of the world. Since 9/11, 430,000 Americans have been shot to death. In World War II, we lost 475,000 people killed. Since World War II, over 2 million Americans have been shot to death domestically. And the press, not you guys, because you're gold, but I mean the main press, needs to put these facts out there to put this thing in perspective.
Thank you so much for the call, Richard, and for the kind words. Media, Mustafa Bayoumi, back to the question about, you know, it seems that the reflection of the reality is distorted, just like Richard says. Why do you think that is, first of all?
I think what Richard says is by and large true. And, you know, if you look at the school shooters as an example, you'll see that within 1 year, often it's you have more deaths by school shooters than you have at the hands of Muslims in this country post 9/11, the whole 14 years. And so there is this radically distorted how Muslims are treated. And you see that all the time, too, whenever you have people talk about this frequently. But when you have a white shooter, it's usually there's mitigating factors that are brought into play. There's questions of mental stability and these sorts of questions. Whereas with a Muslim, there's always a presumption first that it has to be that this person was acting ideologically. And then if there's any movement from there, then there's an inquiry into his personality after that. So clearly there's a rich bias that invades the coverage of Muslims in this country, because there's this idea, it really does seem to me, that Muslims occupy a different kind of ideological and mental space than the rest of America. The media it functions very clearly with a lot of stereotypes. Those stereotypes get promoted over and over again, and they become unconscious. And I think that we do have to confront that question.
And then presidential hopefuls like Donald Trump says he supports monitoring select mosques and a database to track Muslims. He's distanced himself from those comments since, but even prior to the Paris attacks, Ben Carson said he was opposed to a Muslim American president. These are people who want to be the president of the United States. Maz, when you hear those kinds of things coming from high political leaders, what goes through your head?
I think what's more horrifying for me than hearing these comments is not hearing them labeled as flat-out bigotry by the mainstream media. And to me, that's horrifying. And I feel like going back to this idea of the media, it plays a tremendous role in shaping our stereotypes, and it always has. And to me, what's interesting is there's, like Richard had brought up, there's so many other things, so many other factors. We've lost so many countless lives at the hands of various other things outside of just specifically radical Islamic terrorism. Yet those things are not, we don't see these in the media at all. And to me, what's fascinating is when we look at the number one export of this country, it's arms, right? And so I can't help but feel like we have a vested interest in raising Islamophobia in this war on terror because of that very fact, right? We're so dependent economically on these wars persisting. And to me, it's scary to think where this is going to lead us.
Mm. And you are studying Islamic theology, mm-hmm. right? Is that right? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, what do you think anything needs to happen within the Muslim community in terms of, or not just organizing, but kind of an inner kind of reflection or not?
So I know the word that gets thrown around a lot, and I guess you were careful not to use it, but the word reformation comes up a lot. Do we need a reformation within Islam? And a lot of mainstream scholars have argued that what we're seeing with ISIS is the call to reformation. Right. This isn't what Orthodox Islam has said for years. This is that voice that's trying to say we need to reform things and do things differently. But Orthodox Islam, by and large, hasn't been of this hue. Right. And so Muslims have. And if you look at the statistics, if you take an ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, all these organizations, they don't make up 1% of the greater Muslim population in the world. Right. Yet, again, going back to media, it's not going to sit here and say, hey, let's look at the Muslims in Indonesia. Let's look at the Muslims here and there. They're going to say it's all about the shock factor. What's shocking for us? What's shocking for us is seeing ISIS beheading people. And for that reason, we're focusing on these things. But going back to your question, whether we need to see a reform, I think we need to, as Muslims, remind ourselves of where we were before these voices of reform started coming up and about. And remind ourselves of these principles that we've held fast to for centuries and that gave rise to great civilizations. And we forget that the West stands on the shoulders of people like Ibn Sina, Avicenna, or Averroes, and these individuals. And these individuals were products of Islamic civilization when it was healthy. But I feel like the bigotry in the media only gives a louder voice to that minority that's calling for this reformation, mm. and it's counterproductive.
And that's reformation kind of the other way.
Yep.
I don't know if I'd call it reformation, but let's go to some more callers. Our lines are full at 866-798-8255. Hi, welcome to your call. Hi.
Hello.
It's you.
Hello?
Go ahead. Yes.
Yes, actually, my question was a little similar. I was wondering, are there any changes or reforms you would like to see in Islam in current day and time? Or are you okay with the status right now?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the call. Mustafa Bayoumi, any changes you'd like to see? I guess that's kind of piggybacking off of the reform conversation. In Muslim communities, or quote-unquote, as he said, in Islam, but it's really, I think, in Muslims today.
I think that's one of the things is that's at the heart of the question is that, you know, Islam is actually, there are so many different ways that the faith is practiced globally, So when people talk about Islam as one unified object, too, I think that that's simplifying a very complex situation, and often the simplification does not move things forward. The one thing that I do think, though, that the Muslims would be beneficial for Muslims generally is not to get excitable when every bric-a-brac is thrown their way, such as we saw with the Danish cartoon controversy, or when the Innocence of Muslims, that movie came out several years ago, and that caused all this kerfuffle internationally and these sorts of things. I mean, most of those demonstrations that we see across the world are usually driven by local domestic politics, which is something that we generally don't pay attention to in the United States. But on the whole, I think Muslims would do better to not get excited and, in fact, engage rather than condemn in these sorts of situations. Though that doesn't mean that, of course, Muslims are not able to present their own opinions forcefully or strongly internationally. But on the whole, I think that in the American Muslim community, I think what we've seen is the American Muslim community has generally matured a lot since 9/11 insofar as it reaches out to other faith groups. They are trying to be very involved in the affairs of this country in a very direct way. You know, I'm old enough to remember what life was like prior to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the American Muslim community, on the whole, was generally concerned with overseas politics more than they were concerned with their domestic lives here. And I think now they're just as concerned with overseas politics, but they're also very concerned with how domestic affairs are run in this country for obvious reasons. And I think that that's actually a good thing. I think that bodes well for the community.
Noor Abdelhal, are there any conversations that you're hearing among students about Islamophobia? Are you having any kind of events or talks at the high school level that you're hearing about?
Well, first, I would like to add, in addition to the way media portrays Muslims, I think there's a lack of education. Mm. Growing up, whenever we would talk about Arabs in school, if we did at all, we seldom did. It would usually be about wars or about how they're like savage or barbaric and the backwardsness, quote unquote, of the practices. So I didn't even know about the Islamic Golden Age until about 2 months ago.
Didn't know it?
Yeah. I didn't even know.
Interesting. Yes. But that says a lot. Uh-huh.
So I think there's really like a lack of education, a lack of representation in our schools even, which is why AIRAQ has decided to put language pathways in order to promote Arabic education.
Mm-hmm. And in San Francisco schools.
In San Francisco schools, which is great, I think. But going back to in class, I started a club where we could talk about Islamophobia, racism, in addition to sexism. Mm. And I find that a lot of the times everything is really interconnected. And like the things I experience are the things that they experience in a different kind of way. So it's like the same color in a different shade.
Mm-hmm. And is it like the club? Is it gaining more people? Is it gaining are people actually coming to the club?
People do come, but the amount fluctuates, I guess, depending on what's going on during the school. But people do come. And we distributed a survey to ask our other peers, because most of the people at my school are people of color, so mm-hmm. we wanted to see what the environment was like for them. Mm-hmm. And we're basically mainly self-educating right now before we can really like take action and see what needs to be changed at the school.
Are there many Muslims in your high school?
There are a few, but we're not really unified. Mm-hmm. In a way. Mm-hmm. And I try to talk to them a lot, but
it's a work in progress.
It's a work in progress.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Let's go to some of our callers at 866-798-8255. Halil, welcome to your call. Hi. It is you. Hi.
Hello?
Hello. Welcome to your call. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, this is John in San Francisco.
Hi, John.
And I just want to bring up, I really feel for the, especially for the women who wear the scarves, who are Muslim, because I'm a costume designer, so I know the effect that clothing has on, you know, people's outlook. Mm-hmm. Another example is the Orthodox Jews.
Yes.
And, you know, I've seen them in New York with the guys wearing the curls on the side. And, you know, I'm sure the guy that was in the library, he was reacting to the scarf. He wasn't reacting to the young lady. And so I just know and I don't want to say don't wear the scarves anymore, but I think that's enters into it, the whole tradition, you know, the importance of what certain religions mm-hmm. wear in public, you know what I mean?
Right. Thanks for the call. Thank you so much. I think there was a time, I recall after 9/11, that some Islamic scholars put out a decision that if a woman in America or the Western world post 9/11 was feeling threatened, that her life was threatened, she should take it off, like life before mm-hmm. hijab. Is did you hear that, Maaz? Is that valid in theology?
I don't remember hearing that specific ruling going around, but yeah, that is a general principle that any time that your life is threatened, then that takes precedence over what the law says.
So, and it has to be your life that's threatened, or you just feel threatened?
Well, yeah, so if you feel threatened that harm will come to you by wearing the mm-hmm. scarf, for example, then, for example, it would make sense if a ruling like that might have been put in place.
Right, that's the necessity
exactly.
clause
yep.
in Islam. And I guess it would be the same with if you're starving, have pork.
Exactly.
And, exactly. you know, if you're thirsty and there's no water and you're about to die,
yeah,
so have the beer. It's like that?
Exactly. And so what's interesting is I was just reading an article by Dr. Ingrid Mattson found in, and if our listeners aren't familiar, Dr. Sayyid Hussein Nasser and a couple of others have recently published the study Quran. Mm-hmm. And so it's a translation of the Quran with the full commentary, mm-hmm. Which he feels is essential to reading the Quran. And in there's a collection of essays as well. And so Dr. Ingrid Mattson has an essay on how to read the Quran that I was just reading yesterday. And what's fascinating in there is she mentions that we need to rid ourselves of this false idea that somehow the more literate reading is always the more authentic reading. And we see that across the board, not just in Islam. There's just mm-hmm. this idea that literalism is the most authoritative and the voices of reason are the sellouts, right? Whereas when you look at our tradition has never had a problem with reason. Right, and George Muqtasi and others, Franz Rosenthal, and some of these guys have said that one of the greatest achievements of Islam was its ability to flourish without having to rid themselves of the religion, because Islam never had a problem with rationality and reason. And so it's principles like this that made it flourish in the past and that people have forgotten, right? And so that's why, going back to what Noura and others were saying, that education is so paramount, because we have Muslims that really believe that, you know, if they were in a life-threatening situation because, you know, alcohol or because pork or because the scarf, whatever it is, that these things hold as the letter of the law under all circumstances, and that's not always the case. And it's not, and in the circumstances where these things are removed out of necessity, the scholars say that at that point you're not taking an expiation, or a dispensation. Rather, that is the rule for you not to follow the previous rule. Right.
You have to
not follow the rule.
And since we have you, theologian, in the making, we have a number of emails asking, you know, what about the quote unquote controversial texts in the Quran? Aren't these people that are committing all of this violence, are they not relying on verses from the same Quran that you are reading and you are reading and Muslims around the world are reading?
So I want to preface this with a couple of things. Firstly, I think, and this is something I heard one of our teachers say recently, he said that the man that has a pathology of beating his wife and kids has a pathology of beating his wife and kids, regardless of what he cites to justify it. He has a pathology of beating his wife and kids, and he does it despite the text, right? And so even if you were to tell this person that you're reading the text wrong, that doesn't necessarily fix the problem because this person has a sickness, right? I was recently writing a paper on Shah Wali Ullah, who is an interesting figure in South Asian history. And the reason I came across him was when you look at, for example, the South Asia's current religious standing, you have three or four primary schools, all of which are on complete opposite ends of the spectrum, right? So you have the complete literalists, you have the mystics, you have all these people that differ from one another. But what's interesting is all of them claim to be exclusively inheriting the intellectual legacy of this one man. Mm. And to me, that was fascinating because I feel like that's basically what we're seeing here, right? Is you're seeing people that are all claiming to be inheriting the same text, but they're differing.
But they're interpreting it very, very, very differently.
Exactly. And so to me, it was an interesting study because I'm examining the life of this person. And what's fascinating is you find that every single group, the reason that they're able to do this is because no group is adopting the text as a whole. They're all cherry-picking what fits their previous predispositions. Mm-hmm. And so this is essentially the way I like to understand what we're seeing before us is anybody that cherry-picks any part of the text can very easily go back and say, look, I'm following the text. But anybody that's actually looking at the whole text will say, no, you're not. Right? And so all these passages have to be understood with the passages that are before it, with the passages that come after it. There's a story that one of our teachers was telling us where a man comes up to him and tells him a verse similar to this, right? Where he says, God said, if you do this, 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 or that, you're a disbeliever. So the scholar stopped him and he said, oh, okay, do you remember what chapter that verse is in? And the man was like, he wasn't sure. But then the scholar asked him, do you remember the verse before that? The man was silent. He asked him, do you know the verse after that? The man was silent. And so he asked the man, he said, what do you do for a living? And the guy said, I'm a car mechanic. He told him, stay as a car mechanic and do what you do best and let the scholars that have interpreted this tradition for 1,400 years continue to do what they do best.
Yes, you are a theologian, see? There you go. We have just a couple of minutes left. We're going to be taking some final thoughts from everybody. Mustafa Bayoumi, where do we stand now? Where are we going and how can we make it better?
That's a small question.
Small, just a tiny question.
Well, I think where we're standing right now is actually not in a very good position. I think that's obvious to anybody who's following the news in the current state of the world. I think one of the things that's really important to underline, though, is the fact that the history of Islam in this country is very long and very old, and it's not just a phenomenon that began on September 11th of 2001. And in fact, that a third of the Muslim American community is African American, and that before 9/11, we would have thought of African Americans when you talk about Islam, rather than when we think about Arabs today as being the face of Islam. And so I think it's really important to kind of put a context into what we're talking about, when we understand our history, when we understand our religious history, but also our national history, we'll be able to work together as a nation to solve some of these pressing problems.
Are you fearful for yourself or your family?
I am, actually. I am. Just recently we had the mayor of Roanoke, Virginia, approvingly cite Japanese internment for a reason not to allow Syrian refugees into his city. That's astonishing to me. I mean, that's basically beyond the pale of reasonable discourse in this country. And yet he eventually had to retract it. But the fact that these kinds of ideas are floating around does make me very concerned.
All right. Noura Abdelal, high school with your scarf on.
Yeah.
Trying to make a difference and have a club. What do you think? What do you feel is going to happen now?
First, I would like to talk about what the caller said. Not really being about the lady, but the scarf. Mm-hmm. And I am the person in the scarf. Like, the scarf is a part of the lady. It's a part of me, and it's a part of my identity. And it's just one part of my identity. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to change is through education and through really looking at grassroots organizations, catching up with their work, being in solidarity with those organizations, because they really reflect the community's interests and they really fight for social justice and equity.
Work that is already being done, support it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And support her club at Burton High School, everybody, please. And Moaz Inam, some final thoughts. What do you think? What should happen now?
Yeah, I think I think an interesting phenomenon that we see in history is, for some reason, what a Muslim in America has to say on Islam is not deemed very authoritative in mainstream media. And we see this often, where people will say, okay, this is what you have to say, but the reality is otherwise. You're the exception, not the rule. And we saw this in the past. We saw this with blacks and every minority in this country. We see this where the people within that community can only scream so loud, but yet they're not heard. Mm. And so I feel what we really need as Muslims in this country right now is allies outside of our faith that understand the reality of the situation, that can stand by us as the white abolitionists stood by the blacks during the persecution. Because I feel like that's what we really need. Unfortunately, we're at a point where people are just not hearing what Muslims have to say. And I feel like it's going to take the voices of others that are outside the faith to legitimize, unfortunately, the voices that Muslims or the things that Muslims have been saying for years.
Hmm. That's an interesting perspective as well. Well, thank you so much mm-hmm. for being here. Thank you, Noura Abdelal, Muaz Inam from Zaytuna College in Berkeley. And thank you, Mustafa Bayoumi, all the way from New York. Thanks for joining us, author of This Muslim American Life. I'm Hannah Baba. Keep those emails coming at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time. On the next Your Call, we're talking football, specifically Super Bowl 50. An estimated 1 million people will partake in the Super Bowl's week-long festivities. San Francisco, Santa Clara, and San Jose are all vying for fans pouring into the Bay Area ready to splurge. So how will the big game transform the region, and what effect will it have on residents? Join the conversation on Your Call with Renee Kemp and you. Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.